Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
So listen, how's your Christmas shopping going? You haven't started yet, have you? Well, fear not, the big interview is here to help solve all your problems. For the football fans in your life, here's three stocking fillers. Firstly, the documentary film of my book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World, is now available everywhere on DVD and digital download. Take the Ball, Pass the Ball is the definitive story, we like to say, of the greatest football team ever assembled, and features exclusive interviews with Barca's stellar cast of current and ex-players, including that geezer Lionel Messi, Xavi, Andres Iniesta, Thierry Henry, Dani Alves, Gerard Piqué, Carlos Puyol and Sergio Busquets, plus a rare exclusive contribution from Pep Guardiola himself. There, that's that one present sorted. Secondly, my old chum and fellow dandy, Jonathan Northcroft, has a new book out published by Backpage, these marvellous people that bring you the books, the podcasts. It's called Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, and it's Jonathan's World Cup diary from Russia last summer, and it's essential reading for the football fan in your life. Finally, check out another Backpage book, Football 2.0, How the World's Best Play the Modern Game by Grant Wall. Through extensive interviews with one player in every key position on and off the pitch, Grant breaks down the technical and tactical revolutions which have transformed football. So, there you have it. Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, Football 2.0. That's not only difficult to say, it's Christmas sorted. Courtesy of your friends at The Big Interview. You're ho, ho, ho. Welcome. Hello there, Big Interview listeners. David Preece is a football analyst who forces you to think different thoughts about the game we all love. Through his journalism and broadcasting, he's carved out a really impressive niche as an expert and an articulate expert on the art of goalkeeping. The analysis of that position has tended to be a cliché minefield, scattered with lazy reflections on how goalkeepers are all mad and how they should never be beaten at the near post. David is taking the debate to a new level. Plus, he's a dandy and extremely funny. So we simply had to have him on The Big Interview. Enjoy David Preece in TalkSport Studios. A very funny, very bright man who's going places. Probably his top corner for a fingertip save.
For some time, Sky, and then I think BBC Radio 5, latterly, and there are things on TalkSport too, but definitely BT Sport. People began to say to ex-professionals of all colours and stripes and ages, we need more from you than turning up and just saying what you see. Thought, planning, analysis, honesty, and so on and so forth. But there has been a desire for tactical analysis that I think began with Andy Gray. Obviously, there were people as good as him, but just maybe not doing it. Sky pushed that. Now, I think you are in the vanguard of a new sector, because one thing, as we know, kind of escaped that era of analysis and explanation well. And therefore, I go to this quote. It's a different profession on the pitch. No one can judge a different profession. How could I judge a nuclear engineer if I knew nothing about his specialty? We don't feel protected. We're vulnerable to those who don't understand what we do and influence public opinion. Nobody seems to understand, for example, that the most difficult things can be the things that others don't see. Speaking to a defender at the right time, that can mean that you don't concede a goal. I'll give you a clue in that He won the World Cup in 2006. He captained Juventus in Italy for a long time. He's at Paris Saint-Germain right now, and it's not Neymar. So when Gigi Buffon talks like that, do you recognise the themes?
Massively. And I think, he mentioned like sort of the nuclear worker, but it's like he's just trying to make a point. And it's, I mean, I retweeted that and I got a lot of stick over it, and a lot of people saying, he kicks a ball and catches it for a living, you know what I mean? And it's like,
I can't believe people are still saying that now. Yeah. That really frightens me.
And I try to say that a manager can't coach different positions on the pitch, even though he's only played one position. It's not just saying that, but just saying that. And I've said it for a long time now. The narrative about goalkeeping has been allowed to be led by outfield goalkeepers, so that's why you have the myths about you should be beating it in the near post. You know, the punching's a negative. Mm-hmm. That it should always catch. It's frustrating, and we're to blame for that. Goalkeepers ourselves are blaming that because it is. Say it's a union. It's not really, you know, of course, not a union, but there is sort of like an unwillingness to be critical. Mm-hmm. Because we know how difficult the job is. It's a difficult job in relative terms. Do you know what I mean? It's not being a nurse or a doctor or a fireman. Do you know what I mean?
No, granted.
But in our sport, then, it is difficult and so much more nuanced than anybody has given it credit for in the past. It's not to say that it hasn't been taken seriously in the past, because there's you know, if you look back at the history of goalkeeping, you look back into sort of like the way that Russia and Germany and places like that look at goalkeeping, the goalkeepers are venerated.
Sepp Maier, I grew up thinking was literally unbeatable. Mm. You know, the most iconic World Cup when I was growing up was 70. I remember my dad's reaction to 66, but I don't remember particularly. But Banks' save is almost as iconic as Pelé's goals in that World Cup and around the world too. Yashin, I was told, was, again, I never saw him, but people would tell me, unbeatable. So I agree with you.
I wish I'd been able to see him. Mm. I wish I'd been able to see what his training was like. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's, with some people in different sports, it kind of doesn't matter what era was their time. Mm-hmm. It's almost transferable, any greatness is transferable any era. But it's, yeah, so like I said before, I mean, the big thing for me was like this thing about the top hand and how it's supposed to be flashing. It's a huge thing for me.
I didn't understand it. You ticked me off on it once, or at least corrected me, because not because of any received wisdom, sometimes when I see keeper going fully extended to his left or right, quite high, and so which hand do I mean? Yeah, I kind of think that the lower arm, whichever way you're going, you should be waiting until the ball is kind of coming to you. And there feels like that the upper arm is shorter. I'm showing you as we speak, and I know I'm wrong.
No, but there's an arc there. But it's not just about sort of like higher reach. That's the minimum that you're getting from that. But also, because you're going across that side, this arm coming across creates a lot more momentum to push off.
Yeah, brilliant, yeah. I looked at you. I'm going to cheat now because I've got an order of questions, but show me your hands.
Not particularly bigger.
But also, I mean, it's a symbol of the times. One of the most impactful things, I met Stepney just after the Zidane European Cup final at Hampden in, I think, 2002 it maybe was. And it was socially in the area afterwards, his hands, like two big cauliflowers, because the ball was wet and hard. And I mean, they were deformed and cut and bruised and knobbly, and you don't particularly look as if you've been in the waters.
Apart from this, I mean, I've broke every single one of them multiple times, especially my thumbs and I've got a plate in my wrist here. I mean, injuries were a curse.
You mean what you said? You've broken every finger?
Oh, everything. I mean, this here, there's nothing. There's no
That's
sort of
right hand middle finger.
Do you know why I did that?
I've got
a cottage in the middle there, but I did that at half time at East End Park. That's Dunfermline,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And then, and it was knackered. It was just sort of like, it was really badly sort of out of shape. And then Peter Kerr decided to come off about 15 minutes before the end of the game. Now to go on. We drew 0-0, but he got injured in the first 5 minutes, decided just to play on, and then came off in the last 15 minutes.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah.
At half time at East End Park, you were the reserve.
Just warm up.
Just warm up. You see, I'm sneaky like this. Were you raking your boots over the opposition penalty area.
Yeah,
I used to do that quite a lot. It's probably.
Have you got Italian blood? Because I love
me.
This is very. This is very Sicilian.
It was just that. Every time I was on the bench, if I was warming up at half time, and then if we were warming up in the half that the opposition were going to be playing in.
Second half?
Where the goalkeeper was going to be. Yeah, I'd just go across the like 6 yard box and dig my heel into the air. So it might take. And I don't know whether it ever worked. Whether it's
looking for a nice little evil bounce.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know it's
definitely isn't a keeper's union. You've just proven your point.
Yeah, but it was, I don't know, it was just...
Competitive spirit is all it is.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I'm all for it, man, I love it. But why have you picked on Germany and Russia and saying that they venerate their keepers differently? How have you learned that?
I was just reading up on them. I didn't say to study in goalkeepers, but I was just sort of really wanting to... Everything that I'd get my hands on when I was younger about... Yeah. My two favourite goalkeepers when I was younger was Bruce Goblar and Neville Southall.
Quite different.
Yeah, very different.
Stylistically.
Very different, but I think I love the way that, obviously, the way that Bruce played the game. And it was totally different from anything else at the time. And but with Neville Southall, I just loved his sort of his work ethic. I remember I was a kid, I went to Everton's training ground.
Belfield.
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was Belfield, yeah. And just watching him train, it just like everything, every training session I watched him, because I went down there a few times, he never left anything. Hmm. Every bit of ounce of energy he had was used in training. Mm-hmm. And he was somebody who, if I could read anything about him, I would always try and look it up. And I would just wish there was the internet back then. Sort of.
Yeah.
But it was about work ethic and about... His warm-ups, I remember reading about his warm-ups, how sometimes he would just have a bath for a warm-up. Then other days he would go out at 1:30 before a game. And it always changed throughout his career. And it was that sort of... It was his work ethic. And Martin Hodge at Sheffield Wednesday, mm-hmm. not a keeper that I particularly sort of admired or had watched a great deal, but I read quite a bit about him, just a few articles that I picked up. And it was... People talking about him, how he's the most hardest working goalkeeper to work his game every day. And that's what I took into my game. Whether I wasn't talented enough or whether I was, you know, whether I was going to be lucky or not, I was going to work hard. That's what I decided. And I think that was my biggest asset more than anything.
And when you match that with what you already said was an attitude for deconstructing things, analysing things, that's maybe been the combination that leaves you now, having had a good career, able to transmit things, or analytically, do you consider yourself somebody who could go in and make goalkeepers at any level, potentially make them better?
Yeah, any level. I really do believe that. It's no arrogance or anything like that, but I just think I've got a great eye for picking up things that I think what's wrong, making little improvements.
It's time for a sponsor question from Bet365, who support us and are behind us. I've got three I can choose. Do you want A, B or C?
Oh, A.
Good, very good choice. What are the best and worst things about being a goalkeeper?
Do you know the best thing about being a goalkeeper is being different? That's one of the reasons why it felt right to be a goalkeeper. Dress differently, wear the gloves. The worst is probably... that moment when the ball goes past you.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, you could describe it as the net rustling, or it's a combination of things. There's definitely a unique noise when the ball hits the back of the net or it hits the post. Perhaps that's the worst moment, when you hear the ball hit the post and you turn around in hope and it's still in the back of the net rather than bouncing straight out again. But definitely... It's funny, you know, sometimes when you get older, it's easier to deal with either disappointments or things that do affect you when you're younger. But that's one thing that got worse as I got older, and sort of it created a greater emotional response from us. Because
pit to the stomach?
Oh, horrible,
or?
Horrible. Yeah, horrible. I think I had a couple of seasons where I worked with a sports psychologist. I worked with sports psychologists all my career, but there was a 2 years 3-year span, maybe. My last 3 years at Aberdeen, where I tried to take emotion out of it. Mm-hmm. And even though I probably played my best football then, I didn't enjoy it. And it's almost that sort of the pain.
Pain and the pleasure, you have to have it.
Yeah. And that's what you miss. People say you miss camaraderie in the dressing room, that and the banter. For that, you just miss being around people. That's what it is. It's not that one Saturday morning it might be butterflies, the next Saturday morning it might be sort of like nauseous.
Yeah.
But
we
that's
have
what you
to
miss.
Have fear and risk to live. Mm. Living isn't about getting by. You have to risk things. Mm. You have to be in the game and whatever that brings with it.
And even coaching, even going out on the pitch, and then I still felt a connection between the goalkeeper who was coaching, but there was still a detachment there. I didn't feel the same. Whereas working in here or working at a live game and doing sort of like live core comms or doing live radio, that's the first time I've really felt anything like that, where it's sort of... People might call it a buzz, like, you know, but it's the first time that I've felt anywhere near that.
It's really good answers to those questions, because there's no prep thrown at you. Enjoyed it. I remember once we had a little Twitter direct message conversation about Claudio Bravo, and it was really evident that you were soaking up everything you could learn about him in order to be able to talk about him properly in that mode that I love about you and other ex-pros, managers or footballers, where I respect that they do their work as well as just saying what they see. You studied him and you watched him and you looked at... I think you were expecting Pep Guardiola in that instance to have signed a goalkeeper who had very good footballing skills when under pressure, the ball at his feet. Not just people, even now that we're talking about that, for my taste at least, people talk about, like, can he control it and kick it? Mm. Whereas what we're actually asking is the control quite natural? Is he a footballer? Is he an outfield footballer? Mm. It's 11 footballers. And is his brain good about, if they're not moving for me and showing their right position, I'll make sure that they do, and I'll get them to spread, and I'll make sure they take responsibility. Does he make the right choices with the ball? Because effectively, when he's a goalkeeper's pressed, he's like a pivoting midfielder, just not in the middle of the park. It's the same decision-making process about when's the press coming, what time do I have, is the ball under control, who do I pick, what is the strategy about why I pick, all that kind of stuff. So therefore, on that basis, where do you stand on the way in which two clubs play a different brand of football from one another, have invested in Brazilian keepers? Have you been looking at Ederson, Alisson, and what's your thoughts, your summation on them?
Well, I've changed. I mean, of course, football changes, so you've got to change with it. But I've totally changed my perspective on goalkeepers dealing with back passes, because it probably comes from... it does come from what we talked about my childhood, when you talk about that fear and having sort of like that fear inducing anxiety, that kind of sort of never left me. So like I was always thought or convinced myself that everything should be safety first. I was ultra safe. Mm-hmm. So back when I was at Darlington, I took Monty with me. Manager David Hodgson asked me who I wanted as goalkeeping coach, and I said Monty.
And
took Monty with us, and even back then we used to talk about playing triangles in the round outside the box, and so that eventually in three passes you would be beyond the defenders and the striker and literally joining in. I've not really seen many other. I've seen people come out of the box, Neuer and Ter Stegen and the two Brazilian lads. Yeah, they'll join outside the box, but you don't have an overlapping goalkeeper. And that's what Monty was talking about. And he was talking about, he wished we could play 4-3-3.
We're talking the region 94, 95, 96-ish?
97, it'd be 97,
okay.
98.
Okay.
And we talked about it, and there was two drawbacks that Feetham's was only good for planting potatoes on. Darlington's football ground, the old football ground. And we had a real problem with the surface, where they tried everything. They brought worms from Old Trafford to aerate the pitch, and we ended up having playing FA Cup games at the Riverside, Middlesbrough. Well.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was a problem.
Listen, you're talking to a complainer. Pataudry was never that great. Neither.
No, it wasn't, to be honest with you.
No.
That was it.
The problem
with Feetham's
is that you can never. The bobble's crazy, right? It's not made for technique and calm when you receive a ball in a triangle.
Yeah, exactly. You're always having to take a touch to get the ball under control first. But also, at that time, you're 5 years into the back pass rule, and defenders didn't want to know.
Get it away.
When the ball came back to you, and normally it would come back to you up here, they weren't bothered how it came back to you.
When you said that, it came back to you. One, you've got a particular player in mind who always used to give you... You've kind of done like bodyline bowling. You said the ball's coming up to you. He's gone for his Adam's apple there. So if the ball's been put to you up at your neck...
The defenders weren't bothered about sort of care about how...
They handed you their problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'll bet you they turned their back and all.
All you saw was four arses. So you couldn't...
Your problem now!
Yeah, and so you just had to hit it first time and people were sort of rushing at you to try and hurry you. So it wasn't really the right environment to try and play football. It wasn't until really I went to Denmark that we did our goalkeeping separately, but not just 40 minutes before training, then joining with everyone else. We did it there separately in the morning and afternoon, and we just trained as normal. So we do the passing drills, do the position drills. And,
yeah.
Which is really beneficial.
You know, we don't. One of the reasons I moved to Spain was I was obsessed by seeing more training. Where in Britain, it's like, no, you can't see training.
Yeah.
If you want proper journalism and analysis, let us learn.
Yeah.
And then gradually the gates have been closed in Spain. Not all of them, but they've been closed too much. So when you go to a tournament with Spain, particularly if you're TV producing, you see a lot. And you watch both Pepe Reina, not Iker, Iker's different. You watch Pepe Reina and De Gea playing in the drills, and they could play outfield. They could both play outfield.
Barca used to come to Denmark every... I don't know if they still do it, but when I was there, they came to Denmark every summer to play friendly. So they'd have, like, 2 days training or so. Most of the time they played in Aarhus, so they train on the pitch for 2 days and then they play against Aarhus on the next day then. So it was free to go and watch. I was sitting in the stand watching train, and it was just fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I always did it. When I went away with teams, particularly with Aberdeen, we go to Holland, Germany, wherever. And when I was in Denmark, you go away to training camps. So I'd go to the local clubs, wherever it was, Twente or,
Snellers, hello.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And go and watch them train, or try to pick up something. And I was always looking for, like, the magic pill that would make me the greatest goalkeeper that ever lived. And, you know, whatever drill it was, whatever technique they would use. And you know what? Most of the time, you go to these places and you've not seen anything. They're not doing anything different from what we're doing. Mm-mm. So I'd go and see... I think Victor might have just come into the team at...
if you're talking, I suppose when you went to Denmark, I suppose we're talking about mid-2000s? Or
it was 2005 to 9.
Yeah, so Victor was certainly... He was the first-choice keeper in 2005-6. Mm. Pepe Reina had gone to Villarreal, so yeah,
Pepe wasn't there.
It would have been Victor, yeah.
Yeah, so like, I remember watching him train. And it was really basic stuff, but I mean, they just come from a tour somewhere and then they were just doing a few live sessions. I think, who's the other one who was a goalkeeper there? I can't remember who the goalkeeper was, but they would go on the side of the pitch and they would use them as sort of like, you know, possession. And those two players and Samuel Eto'o were the three best players in those sessions. And I was blown away by Samuel Eto'o.
We could spend the rest of the day about Eto'o. He's hugely underrated because he was such a ferocious, pugnacious, I interviewed him once. And like, this is what people had to put up with. He was a Barcelona player. He was doing this interview for UEFA's Champions League magazine. And just like we sent the Bet365 questions, people had sent in questions. So what could you list your five proudest achievements? And actually, he was a current Barca player. He'd already won the 2006 Champions League and scored in the final. Changed it largely because of his goal and his participation in the second goal. And he listed... and being born in Cameroon, moving to Spain, winning the Champions League with Real Madrid, which he didn't. He was on the books, didn't play a single game, didn't list anything about Barcelona, didn't list the 2006 Champions League final in which he had to pin Barcelona that day. So he listed winning the Champions League with Real Madrid. And, you know, he drove Pep mad because he would lose his temper and he would wave his arms around and shout. But as a footballer, I mean, I've never seen the likes of it. Made every defender's life utter misery. His movement, his athleticism, his ability to score every kind of goal imaginable. Mm. Albeit that he's a big man or a tall man, but he had literally everything. But whenever we meet people like you, all of you, it's that innate will to win, competitiveness, edge, and you read it and you hear it, and they all go, "I can't bear to lose it." This you can't, and then you meet them and you listen to them, and they can't. Mm. Or if you ever happen to be present. They can't, but he was like... times a thousand.
I don't know whether it was the case, whether it's just to keep him happy, because every time, I mean, it was probably about a dozen times I watched over the years I've watched them train. He was always the joker, you know, playing for both sides and only had two touches. Rijkaard always made him
I like you call it the joker. So it's the guy who can maybe, like, you wear this odd coloured
dress. Whoever's in possession,
you're the comodine, you play for both.
Yeah.
So that's a common exercise that you knew and saw in your.
Yeah, but most of the time that was just used for odd numbers, but you can see with... With him there was a purpose to it.
Yeah. It's quite a common thing in Spanish training. And I suppose the idea is, it keeps everybody around you mentally sharp, because you've got the ball and you're passing them, and the instant that you haven't got the ball, he's on the other side.
Yeah.
Instantly, and in tight spaces. So your alertness has to change, and so does the player himself. I've always thought it's about your mind there, I guess.
But most of the time, it doesn't matter who it is, whichever team you're watching or who's training. Most of the time, that player can be quite passive. So, like, they're just used if they're needed, where everything just came through him, and he was, you know, changing position all the time and wanting the ball. And, I didn't appreciate him until then.
I think only one... I don't think... he's played for every Champions League winner bar Bayern Munich since 2009. Every Champions League winner he's played for. Played competitively for Real Madrid and you know, often enough, and Chelsea and Barcelona. And he's the only footballer who's won two trebles with two different clubs. It's extraordinary. I told you we could use it. But so you're in... where are we? We're in Aarhus, in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
And you're watching Victor Valdes. And you went to study that, because we were talking then about, you know, the way in which you were linking what you saw there to what you see now with Alisson and Ederson. You said that when I offered you a chance to talk about, like, what you see in the two of them to your satisfaction as an analyst, you immediately went, well, I've changed my idea about pressing and passing and the six-yard box and what keepers want to be doing there, because it's utterly distinct from what you had in your playing life.
It is, and it's... We have to look at a different perspective now. That the people that I speak to about it, and I really, really love him, because he's got great ideas. A guy called Tim Dittmer, who's at the FA now, he's head of goalkeeping development. I love talking to him. Don't talk to him enough.
Let's give him praise again. Tim? Yeah.
Tim Dittmer,
D-I-T-T-M-E-R. That's big praise.
Yeah, and you know, you're looking for somebody who's an innovator, who's doing something a little different and thinking a little bit differently, and that's what I was always looking for. So it's about taking the fear out of goalkeeping, and especially with the ball at your feet. Now, I spoke about, you know, overlapping goalkeepers and that, and it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but if we could do that, that would be sort of utopia. Mm. Because then you really have the... Not sweeper keeper.
11 footballers.
Yeah, 11 outright footballers. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And not 10 plus 1.
So to do that, you take the goal out of it. So if you take the goal out of it, you take the fear out of it and the risk. So then players would react and position themselves and move the way they would in midfield or up front. And that's it. And ideally, you'd want the ball in the corner, so you get everything tracked over that way and then come out the other side. So everyone's tracked down there, you go to hit them down the weak side. And
overloading, like, it's a pep technique to overload, bring, come on into my parlour, send this player into the fly, bosh, change of direction.
And the problem with the way we've had it so far, especially this season when so many teams are doing it, is that the problems Petr Cech had at Arsenal, they weren't Petr Cech's problems, they were Arsenal's problems as a whole, because one, they weren't moving properly for him, Socrates didn't really, he was uncomfortable with the ball, Granit Xhaka offered himself, but in a kind of, yeah, I'll have it, I don't really want it, but I'll have it, I'll show, and there's no purpose towards it.
Yeah.
So it was just, it was literally, Tottenham against Barca, last goal, Lloris. Trippier gave the ball away, but that's Lloris's fault, because he'd give the ball to Trippier, but Trippier's got no real obvious out ball apart from just hitting that line. He doesn't want to do that. So Lloris has got a little bit more time on the ball than Trippier's got, so he should play the ball sooner, because he's got more composure, he's got more time to look up, he's not under that much pressure. So it has to be a pass that's... When Lloris is passing the ball, he needs to pass him there with the thought of, well, if I pass it to you, then it's going to go to him, or it's going to go to him. There's got to be a pattern there.
But everything you've said there, because whether Lloris is the best keeper in the world or not, or whether he's the best at this specific art that we're talking about now, playing like a central midfielder but in a six-yard box, Every footballer, just as you've detailed, needs to have that, you know, 16 decisions every 2 seconds in his head at a time when you're alert, when you're confident, when you're either in form or sharp, where it's automatic, where you talked about, like, you don't think. I think you were probably talking about movement and one-on-ones, but it's to me, you know, he made bad decisions, he did the wrong thing, because he's come back after a spell where he's had a little bit difficult time personally. He's patently not in form. His sliding mad challenge out to try and meet Jordi Alba, I think, for the first goal, showed it's a completely different error, but showed the guy where there's still some cotton wool in the head. And that's exactly maybe that affects.
That's exactly what it is, yeah.
The Trippier, the decision to when and how to give the ball to Trippier.
So, and like I said, go back to Petr Cech. It's about sort of, it's got to be a purpose. You can't just give it to him because he's free.
Yeah.
Because you've got to think, well, what's he going to do with it?
What's next?
And most of the time, when you do that, it just comes back to you and you've got to hit it along anyway.
Mm.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot of big names in goalkeeping at the moment. Rather than going through them all in terms of like what they're good at and not good at, who, if we go through, you know, Ederson and De Gea and Alisson and Kepa and young Schmeichel, Subasic, Pickford, Ochoa, right across them all, Oblak, who in your, you know, top five, top six, who would be your top two just out of personal preference? And in that group of keepers at the moment, who do you think is underrated, misunderstood?
Underrated.
Given enough credit.
I'll have a little bit think about that, but I'll always go back to Buffon. He's the keeper that's. I know that I say that, you know, like so Grobbelaar and people like that who like maybe a bit more extravagant, you know.
For sure.
Yeah. But I just like, I love everything about Buffon. I just love that him as a man. We can talk about things that he said and done in the past. We can talk about
he's
that.
Really that much of an inspirational figure
massively,
for you?
Massively.
I didn't know that.
But he's the biggest thing for me that I took from him and that I admire about him, up until recently, you didn't really see him make any bad decisions. You know, and I know that comes with playing with consistently with some of the best defenders, European football or world football scene, and the relationship that you build with them, knowing what each other's going to do. But up until the last couple of seasons, you didn't see him come running outside his box or coming for a ball that he was never going to get or panicked in. He was always cool. And when you've got a cool head, you make clear decisions.
He helps with leadership. We're winding towards an end, but I know what I want to ask you about to finish this up. Bet365 has said, for you, the greatest Premier League goalkeeper of all time, Premier League. Again, personal choice.
Yeah, it's just a tough one. I know many people will definitely say Peter Schmeichel, and that might be true, but he was so unique that most of the things that he did and the way that he was aggressive and assertive and proactive was because it worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he did a masterclass, I think it was last season or the season before, on Sky, on Monday Night Football. And he was writing everything that he said, and there was lots of examples of him sort of being dominant and authoritative and... But everything that he did worked for him. And I think for a lot of goalkeepers, it wouldn't necessarily work. And he was very unique that way.
So you're saying not him?
There's one, it's another Man United goalkeeper, Edwin van der Sar, that I've always had a sort of a soft spot for him, because one of the first goalkeeping coaching videos I ever watched was it was him and Stanley Menzo and Franz Hook.
Gosh almighty, Stanley Menzo, I've not heard his name mentioned for a long time.
Ajax.
So this was at Ajax when France was there, still under Van Gaal as coach, and France would have been the goalkeeping coach. Not a very popular man at Old Trafford, France.
Not
liked at all by David Ayer. I'm not selling secrets out of school, it's the truth.
Yeah.
But somebody who succeeded a great deal and was a tutor for Van der Sar.
Yeah.
So you saw what then? That's where the affection comes from.
It was a little bit of the sort of the technique stuff that they worked on. That it was, I mean, obviously I couldn't understand what they were saying, but it was you could see what they were working on, and a lot of it was simple stuff. But the biggest thing was the distribution and how unerringly accurate he was for somebody who's like, was he 6'5" or something like that? He's being pulled, doesn't particularly look like a silky footballer, but his technique was brilliant. His range of passing was brilliant. And it wasn't just that about him, it was just the way that we'd been led into this sort of cliche of a goalkeeper being sort of mad, shouting, screaming, ranting, raving, like Schmeichel, like I said, but that worked for him. For most goalkeepers, that wouldn't work, simply because you get yourself that irate for the next 5 minutes, you're not good to anybody. Where he used it and was able to keep a calm head, where with Van der Sar, he wasn't that goalkeeper. He was cool, he was calm, but he was still authoritative. That's what I loved about
him. This doesn't do you much good in your career. If we'd met earlier, I could have shared this with you and you could have used it for your own, some of your own gut-knowing anxiety. But on the night of Wednesday, 18th March, 1987, Peter Schmeichel was on the team bus for Brøndby against Porto in what was actually the Champions League quarter-final. And he told me that he was so scared about playing in the Champions League at this stage. I don't know who dropped out. I don't know why he was getting his chance. And he told me that he was so scared that he wished the bus would break down and that he couldn't arrive at the ground and it would never happen. And he went out and he played like that. They drew 1-1 and went out, I think, 2-1 aggregate. And he told me that it's a remarkable thing, but I believed him because it was his anecdote, that he talked to himself after that game, that he gave himself a row, and he went, this isn't any good, you made an idiot of yourself, you can't live like this, right? And he was unembarrassed to admit his complete and utter funk about the whole, what was coming up, and he knew that he was telling somebody who couldn't recognise that in the keeper that I watched Denmark and Manchester United and Manchester City, and he talked himself out of it in that one night by giving himself such a row.
Yeah.
He said, I never felt like that again, ever. And I found that a remarkable story about human psychology. Mm. How do you rid yourself of that like that? I thought that was weird. I really did. And until you spoke about Van der Sar, I'd have probably given Schmeichel my vote. Mm. But I loved what you said there. So I want to talk about penalties, the penalty spot. Is it Achterberg who's the keeper coach at Liverpool?
Yeah.
Have I got that name
John
right?
Achterberg.
Did we see him when Riyad Mahrez is about to take a penalty? He comes out on the touchline, doesn't he? And kind of like with his back to the keeper, does his hand up like that to say it's going top right. And I was lucky, I was a witness to in the World Cup that Spain won in 2010. They're playing Paraguay. Pepe Reina's on the bench. Pepe, like you, it felt it was a 12-man team. If you're on the bench, it doesn't mean you're not playing. You're in there, you're competing, and and he yells because he's seen the Paraguay striker playing for Liverpool. He's played against him. He's seen a penalty. He's studied penalties so much, he tells Iker which way it's going to go. Iker hates advice, listens because it's Pepe, takes it and saves it, and they go through 1-0. That whole idea about penalties, concentration, the 1v1 thing, studying penalty takers, which was harder to do with the internet, and I guess much harder in your day to study penalty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it
maybe
was
impossible?
Almost impossible.
Word of mouth, maybe, might have been. But, like, where do you stand on all of that and the psychology of it? And also somebody on the touchline giving you advice, even if it's well-meaning. Good, bad, up for it, not?
No, it's good that, I mean, the fact that it looked different because he was facing away, but it just stops confusion. So if you think,
Don't shout, just show.
Well, exactly, yeah. Well, so not just that, because if you're facing him, and you're saying that, and you go right hand, saying, oh, well, is it your right or my right? At least if he turns away, he knows exactly where it is. But it's it is fascinating just because there's so many layers you can put on top of the research that you do. So, you know, down to what time of the game is it? Are you winning and losing? What's the score? Are you home or away? If you're at home, which end of the pitch it is? Is it in the shootout? Is it in the game? You know, it's just there's so many layers you can put on top of it to try and as a coach, that's what you know. If you've got a penalty taker, he's got a long history of penalties, then you can do that. So you can try and narrow it down a little bit more. So like some, I don't know, I think it was like Harry Kane, who in high pressure situations in big matches against top six sides, he went down the middle a couple of times, and that's when Karius saved last season. He just sort of stood a little bit more.
Kind of intuitive. Yeah. That habit will lead to him making this decision again, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's just fascinating. Just going into that and just, it's almost like a challenge, you know what I mean? It's almost like, it is like a problem.
To me, I love it. It still comes down to the casino, how much work you do. Are you gambling on black or red?
Who was the famous penalty saver in Spain? Was it Diego Alves?
Oh, yeah, Diego Alves, the Brazilian at Valencia.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Extraordinary. I mean, averaging up maybe over 55%.
I think in the end, is he back in Brazil now?
Yes, I think he is.
I think he was at 47%. When you think the average is 22%, one in four penalties getting, around one in five penalties get saved, and his was up to like 47%. And I can't remember somebody who's a writer for the New York Times, but he did an interview with him and a few of his goalkeeping coach at the time. He was a goalkeeping coach at Valencia.
Ocho Torena is always the Spain coach as well.
And they didn't really give away too many secrets, but it was kind of like, He played the penalty through in his head. So if he thought this is where he's going to go, then he sort of played through his mind over and over and over again. So that just as he's about to take it, he almost knew he was going to take it. Now, obviously, 50% time, 53% time, he didn't. But it pushed his average up. And it is a sort of, this is a mental thing. But he was the one who saved two or three Messi's penalties. I know he's not the greatest penalty taker in the world. The greatest player in the world.
Well, there's a little anecdote here, because I've interviewed Messi a lot, and often it's post-match. And sometimes you just get niceties, and sometimes you can't be arsed. And sometimes you ask a straight, ordinary question, really stupid. What were you thinking just before the penalty was taken? And he stopped and he went, I was looking at Abiati and how big he is, and how he'd thrown himself around the goal all game. And Messi said to me, he thought, how am I going to score here? In that instance, he did, because whatever, I think his technique was sufficient with his body to show as if it was going one side, and he does a really nice one on the other side, so it isn't just a technique. Abiati goes the wrong way. But he admitted, the world's greatest player, the greatest player ever, as far as I'm concerned, admitted fear, confusion, also said it out loud.
Yeah.
I was like, don't, okay, well, I want this, but I don't.
Don't ruin it, yeah.
So everybody, you know, no matter how great your technique is or a little pressure you feel, because if you miss a penalty and you're messy, it's got another 3 and 10 minutes.
Alves thought that a couple of times he said the penalties, he didn't say what he said to him, but he just sort of approached him as he's spotting the ball and he feels
me like, again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's what he said the second time, actually. Yeah, I think it's right. Yeah.
Then Bet365 want to know something that you're probably going to find the most difficult and emotional one yet. Do you think Sunderland will achieve automatic promotion this season?
Ooh. Yes.
And that's not emotion, or it is emotion?
No, it's not emotion. I mean, obviously Peterborough, they set off on fire, but they got beat 4-0 at home, and I don't think a team who gets beat 4-0 at home is going to show the same consistency. The thing is with Sunderland and Jack Ross, they're a team that's sort of, they're a young side, young manager, they're sort of learning and growing together.
It's a nice feeling, that.
Yeah, it's something that It's been
all in together,
yeah, exactly,
kind of band of brothers.
We're all
then
learning together, yeah.
You need the talent, obviously. I know you're not, you know, washing over what you need to be. You have to have the right players there, but that feeling of like we're in this together.
Yeah. The one good thing about being sort of relegated into League One is that the gap between sort of academy under 23s and the first team, it's shortened now. So those players, the likes of Denver Hume, are getting a chance to play where ordinarily they wouldn't be anywhere near the first team. And there's a lot of the youth progs are coming through now, and because they've played together, then you get you get that sort of gelling, and that's.
Did I quite like the look of it? Is it Watmore?
Yeah,
I got injured. My eye said to me, I quite like how he plays and how he works.
Yeah, because he's got something about him that's old-fashioned, that's and direct, that's been lost in the game because of the way we play now. Whereas maybe 20 years ago, there'd be a lot of players like him, and maybe he's a little bit easy to defend. Defenders aren't used to coming up against people. Like people who just raw pace, who will just go at you and go at you and go at you.
He also seemed to have a verve to me. He liked taking people on rather than simply running past them. There seemed to be a like, yeah, let's have a bit of fun here.
He's different. He is a thinker.
First class degree, isn't he?
Yeah, he is a thinker, but he's a lovely guy.
Thank you for joining us for season 2018-19. We've got huge creative plans for the months ahead, but we do need your help to make them happen. please go right now to patreon.com/GrahamHunter and become a socio, become a paying member, and get an extra big interview every month, plus loads of bonus content. Last season, socios listened to 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, Roberto Di Matteo, and loads of me talking about football. The Premier League, the Champions League, Spanish football. I'm sure they enjoyed it and you will too. Support us, join us. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.